This is CliffCentral.com.
If Sonia Booth is ready, I'm ready. No, I mean, she's an important woman.
Oh, yeah. So she's on the lineup today, by the way.
Yes, she is. Sonia's been married to Matthew Booth for 11 years. They've got two sons called Noah and Nathan. And Opinion Booth has been on CliffCentral.com since May of this year, every Tuesday at 11 a.m. Hello, beautiful. You sit anywhere you like. How's it, Sonia?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Good. Grab a seat. Where do you want to sit?
How did you know I was here?
Oh, my fave. I know because everything about you. I'm a stalker like that.
Because we saw your car. You've got a very personalized number plate, and you've got to explain it to me. Because Ben was asking, and he's had to run off, but Ben said, does this mean that she and Matthew had marital problems? Because he saw your number plate is prenup or something, right?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So what does that mean? Does that mean that you guys are... Was that a gift from him before the wedding, or how does it work? What does it mean? It's very complicated.
Look at the, you know, political landscape in our country. Someone needs a sense of humor, right?
Oh, so it was just a fun thing. You're like, look,
sense of humor.
Okay.
Yeah.
It makes people think maybe there's something that's happened and you got this as part of the settlement.
No. We're in it for the long haul. I mean, myself and Matthew, you know, we call it Sofa Slatlani, you know. get used to the fact that, you know, as much as he is almost 2 meters tall,
yes.
198, yeah, almost. Just picture us with our walking sticks.
That's
at an old age,
be.
At an old age home.
Well, I've seen you two together here when he's come to Cliff Central, and I've obviously seen you out socially together, and it's really lovely to see a couple that actually care about each other, and both of you are very public figures. So people know you, they recognize you, they come up to you. But you're also just very regular people who are in love. And you're still in love.
We are. I mean, 17 years later.
It's amazing.
You know, who would have thought?
Yeah.
You know, we are still madly in love. I know it sounds weird because people assume that after 17 years it's sort of like, you know, fades away and then the honeymoon fades.
Well, please, for people like Mabali and I, it's like 17 days.
I don't know how you've done it. I don't know how you've survived with him. You know, my condolences. Yeah.
Thank you.
Luckily, we're not married.
I go in for regular therapy, so yes. Thanks.
Oh, poor thing. I feel.
But Sonia, I mean, you guys have got these two boys. How old are they now?
8 and 12.
Okay, so they. I mean, these kids are getting big fast.
Well, the 12-year-old is my height, and I'm 178.
Wow.
What did you expect?
Exactly, yeah.
The two of you are the tallest people in the world, and then you produce kids, and you think they're going to be short?
Good point.
Yeah. I mean, like,
I
think he's going to eventually be able to stop planes like King Kong with his hands.
Now they're very tall. I'm amazing, amazing boys, and unfortunately for me, they very talented football players. I mean, our eight-year-old already had a coach from one of the big development teams wanting to sign him on, and Matthew was like, "Hey, just chill here. I'm the agent."
So he's in support of this because often when kids go into the profession that the parents are in, either they love it,
yeah,
or they are very concerned because they're like, "Oh no, the kid's going to try and follow in my footsteps. This might not work out well." I mean, Matthew did really well as a footballer.
Yeah.
So there's a standard. And then the kids might feel that they have to live up to that in some way, which can be very pressurized.
I think, you know, I'm watching as a mother, watching them grow, obviously, and I was always curious as to what career path they were going to follow, whether they were going to be, you know, sportsmen or academics or whatever.
And let's bear in mind, 12 is not really the age that you decide your career.
No. But I mean, no. As a sportsman, you actually can tell from even the age of 5. Hmm. Matthew started playing at the age of 5. By 8, if a child has no talent, there's no talent.
It's never going to happen.
I mean, obviously, it's got to be groomed.
Sure.
And, you know, with the proper training, you know, that can elevate that growth, if I can put it like that. But, I mean, I can't help it. But I think Matthew is absolutely loving, you know, the fact that he's a potential agent to his two sons. it's a pride thing for him. I mean, he's a proud father. You know, he doesn't make it so obvious, but I know that he's very happy that they're going to be, you know, potentially that they could be professional football players. Yeah.
Are you two worried that, you know, as parents, you're always like, how much do I get involved? How much must I push the kids? Because kids will find their own interests. They might be sporty. They might be into their academic stuff. You can't, as a parent, you can't like push them in a certain direction. But you also have to, when they start finding that, you have to support them in whatever they've decided to do, even if you think there are probably better things for them to be doing. Is that hard?
It is hard. I mean, parenting ain't for the faint-hearted. Sure. I always say, you know, it's not easy. You can only guide them. We're not the kind of parents that push our kids in a particular direction. You know, the assumption would be that Matthew pushed them to pursue football in school and at soccer club level as well. But interestingly enough, our 12-year-old has half colors in hockey. Hmm. So he's got half colors for hockey. He's just won football player of the year at school.
Wow.
So he has half colors in hockey and soccer.
Congrats.
But he plays tennis as well. In fact, that the school coach for tennis recommended, because he saw the talent that he had, recommended that he gets private lessons. Hmm. So he's got half colors in soccer and hockey. And he excels at tennis, and he represents the school in athletics.
Jeez.
But our 8-year-old, he loves soccer. He's not interested. If it doesn't involve soccer, mm-hmm. he's not interested. But he's also a straight-A student. I mean, he gets your 90%. He gets the lowest mark is like 80%. This is our 8-year-old.
I was talking to someone about this the other day because she was saying to me she went to this thing with parents and kids. She doesn't have kids, but she was like babysitting her niece or whatever. She went to this thing, and parents are hugely competitive with each other.
Yeah.
And if you find out that, like, if your 8-year-old was at school with my kid, if I had a kid, and you said, oh, he's, you know, straight-A students, and I'd be like, oh, I hate Sonia Booth. her kid is just great at school and at sport, and my kid is just a lummox that sits there and plays TV games all day.
But I'm not that kind of parent, you know. I don't.
But parents are like that, right? Not you, but there are parents who are hugely competitive.
No, I'm not. And I mean, you know, I'm going to be honest with you that it was a bonus that he happened to be a straight A student. But for us, we all about balance. We're not going to go out and blurt it to the world that, you know, our child is, you know, a straight A student. But I was just trying to make a point that as much as he excels in sports, it's interesting to watch, and I'm curious to see what he's actually going to pursue. Because, I mean, he could end up being an academic if he wants to, because he's got the brains for it. So the point I'm making is that it's amazing to find that, you know, a child of that age who excels in both sports and academia. And then you can't wait to see, okay, what career path
Absolutely.
Are they going to follow?
This is the one thing that I would love, you know, because I say I haven't got kids yet and I reserve the right to change my mind. But if I did, that's the part I'd enjoy the most, is watching them turn into a real human being.
Exactly.
And seeing what they decide and where they're going to go and how they turn out. I mean, that stuff is, it's almost like you are playing the biggest sim game of all.
What's a sim game?
It's a simulation game. Yeah. So you have this child, this creature is brought into the world, and it has certain abilities and certain talents and certain interests, and as it grows, you see it develop into a full human being with all of these things represented, and it could go in any direction. It's kind of like, it's almost like a mini God situation. Like, if there's a God, then that's how he watches us. And sees us develop and go into our different things, and some humans screw up and other ones do well. But this is almost like a mini version of that when you're a parent, right? Mm. Do you know what I mean, Mubs?
Yeah, I suppose it also has a lot to do with the fact that your children, to a degree, are a reflection of you.
Yeah.
So I imagine that must be quite amazing to experience and to watch.
I mean, you know, the fact is, there's no guarantee how a child's going to turn up. I mean, you know, I'm talking about our youngest being a straight A student. There's no guarantee that he's going to excel in life.
Mm.
And there's no guarantee that he's going to represent the family in a positive light.
You can,
and I mean, how they turn out actually is beyond your control. You know, I mean, we know of kids who's, you know, dads are priests and, you know, they end up running the brothel. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's, that's the way of life. So I mean, we can only lead them as parents and lead by example and hope and pray that they turn out on the other side as decent human beings who don't go out with you know, daggers killing people. And
well, it seems to me you two are on the right track.
we believe, like I said, it's not easy. You know, no, if anybody were to tell you that, you know, parenthood is a breeze, they living in fantasy land, it's not easy. But I mean, you know, as a family unit, as a solid family unit, it's trial and error at the end of the day. You learn from other parents, we learn from our parents, but we do what we think is you know, the way to do it.
Tell me, when you and Matthew got together all those years ago, it wasn't as open a society as it is now.
Yeah.
Like in terms of a mixed race relationship, in terms of a footballer, there are all kinds of people have stereotypes and they have ideas of what is going on there. Was it tough for you two when you started seeing each other?
No, you know, I've been asked this question so many times, not even in Russia, and we were not even in a cosmopolitan city like your Moscow and St. Petersburg. We were in like a small city of 1.2 million, 1.5 million people. And even then, as much as I was literally the only black woman in the entire city of 1.5 million people.
And Russia's notoriously a racist country, right?
Exactly. And I never experienced that. I've never experienced it in my own country. But I think it's because, you know, a lot of people know Matthew. And I mean, if you're a fan of football, you knew him, and people warmed up to him, and he's a people's person. So I think that also, you know, pets some weight. But I would be lying to you if I were to say that we experienced problems. No.
I'm happy to hear that, because it means that we're getting somewhere.
Absolutely.
As society, and nobody should have to feel that, whether you're in love with someone. I mean, if, you know, my buddy's always had this thing for dwarves, and if only she...
Are we aren't here to judge?
We're not here to judge.
No.
Thank you.
We'll just love and accept her.
But how are you, first of all, how are you enjoying the show? Are you having fun with that?
I am absolutely loving it. I mean, it's amazing. But you know what? You take for granted the amount of preparation one needs. You have a show 5 days a week. And, I mean, you're seasoned, right? You're experienced. But, I mean, it still takes me a good day to put together a one-hour show. It probably takes you, like, maybe half an hour, you know? And I'm thinking, you know, Gareth has a show 5 days a week. So if I were sitting where you seated now and I had, you know, a show 5 days a week, that would mean I would be preparing 5 days in a row, which is
your kids would not know their mother.
Exactly. No, you underestimate that. You underestimate that. But yeah, kudos to you. Big ups to you.
No, listen, I mean, thank you, but that the reason that you've got this show and you bring in really interesting guests, and I've listened to a couple of them, and you have fantastic conversations with people.
Thank you.
It's because you're an interesting person. So, I mean, a lot of it is prep, but a lot of it is also just you being Sonia.
Absolutely.
Now, you've written these books.
Yes.
Your first book, Reinvent Yourself, was 2015.
The first edition.
Right. So, this is an important thing, and this doesn't just count for celebrities or well-known social people or people who are in football or people who are in the public eye, politicians even. This goes for everyone. Because reinventing yourself is part of keeping everything fresh,
yes.
Right? Why do people struggle with that so much?
I think people underestimate, or people like complacency.
You get into a comfort zone.
You do, which is very, very, very dangerous. And I mean, you know, my book is not only just talking about branding, you know, career-wise, or pushing whatever a career that you're trying to pursue. I mean, I go from you getting comfortable as unradio host, as I call it, because this is unradio, right? Mm-hmm. So you're getting comfortable to a point where you're not even interested in new technologies in as far as putting up a podcast is concerned, or putting together a show like this is concerned. Yeah. The next thing, Mabale takes up your seat because she's gone for refresher course. She's hungrier, absolutely. But she's constantly finding ways to become better than you, but not necessarily from a competition point of view. But she's always keeping abreast of, you know, new technologies. And because you think you're actually getting big-headed and getting to a point of saying, you know, I'm Gareth Cliff, the podcasting industry is nothing without me. That's a problem. A lot of people have that problem. Football players, you know, you're in the starting lineup all the time, mm-hmm. and then you miss training because you were at a shisanyama till 5 o'clock in the morning because you're arrogant enough to think that no, the coach is going to pick me. You know, I'm so and so. There's no starting 11 without me. And then the next thing you know, you pick up weight.
This happens. CEOs of companies. Absolutely. It happens to presidents of countries.
Marriages as well. If you met me as a size zero, and it's going to sound weird, especially today being the first day of Women's Month, if Matthew met me as a size zero, because I was skinny when Matthew met me,
right?
It's disrespectful for me to get comfortable to a point where I now get so overweight to a point where he's no longer physically attracted to me, and then I have a problem with it. But fact is, physical attraction is the first thing before you open your mouth, before I come up to you and say hello. First of all, I would have sized you up.
Yeah,
human beings, we do that. So before you even open your mouth, or before you even come up to me and say, hi, my name is Gareth, I would have, you know, looked at you and thought, you know, think to myself, is he my type? Do I like him? Am I attracted to him?
Yeah.
Right? So if when I met Matthew, as physical as he was, and I mean, fantastic body. I mean, physique like you won't believe. Chiseled, right? Yeah. In every way.
My body's
chiseled.
Excited.
I'm sorry, chiseled. I'm living vicariously through you right
chiseled,
now.
Chiseled, right? And we had this conversation. Myself and Matthew sat down and I said to him, never ever get comfortable. I do not want to have to put up with a man with mkaba. Because the physical attraction from the beginning was this chiseled man. It's not going to be easy at the age of 60, no. But I mean, I've made a promise. When I said to him, don't end up with mkaba, because I will leave you, because I did not get attracted to you with mkaba. If I wanted a guy with mkaba, I would have gone for a guy with mkaba, but don't get comfortable. And I said it to him, and I said, and I will do my best not to gain weight. Obviously, you go through hardships. I mean, there were times when I gained weight, but I hated myself. I mentioned it in surviving ICU, you know, because it was not an easy time, but I was going through a lot. It's human nature. You can never look good all the time. You know what I mean?
But you also became a mother at one point.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that changes a lot.
You know, unless you have, you know, medical problems like an overactive thyroid problem, that's a different story altogether, because your partner has to support you because you didn't ask for it. But I mean, to just sit there and think that, you know, I'm married, I've been with him for 17 years, he's going to love me forever, and then I let myself go, and then I don't look after myself, I don't eat well, and I don't go to gym, it's actually disrespectful. So I don't want him also to get comfortable, and it is what it is, you know. Never ever get into a comfort zone.
No, I agree with that. And staying relevant is a whole different thing too, because being relevant means you actually have to be interested in the world around you and interested in the people around you.
Exactly.
And you have to be willing to listen more than you talk.
Yes.
And being relevant is about not looking old and outdated and boring and people going, oh no, not him or her again.
As a brand, staying relevant, it means you're still in demand, right? It means you still have meaningful contributions in whatever industry that you're in. Being relevant as a radio host, as a DJ, whatever you want to call yourself, that's currency for you. That's your brand. The minute the name Gareth Cliff is mentioned, we're thinking, you know, he's started something incredible in the podcasting industry. So you staying relevant, it means I'm still interested in you and your brand. That's currency. Simple as that.
Well, I think it's a terrific book, and there are lots of people who could benefit from it. That book is still available, right? How many editions now?
Exclusive Books 2. This is the second edition, which you can find Exclusive Books and Scoobs as well.
So that is How to Reinvent Yourself and Stay Relevant.
Yes.
And then your next book was really about a very personal story, and you decided to share with everybody what you went through, which was a difficult health situation. I mean, this cystic fibrosis is no joke. It's a real thing. And it affects so many women. And it's something a lot of people are not sure how to talk about. Because the minute you involve, like, the ovaries or anything in the reproductive system, people get very squeamish. Mm. They get very sensitive. And they don't talk to everybody about this.
You know, we don't even talk to our husbands about things like yeah. that. I mean, it's a taboo subject, which is, it upsets me. You know, and I'm glad that you're talking about it, as a man. I did the book launch, on Thursday at Scoops, and I spoke about, luckily there were men in the audience who had come with their partners, and I was very happy to see men in attendance. And I said to them, it's strange that men only go with their partners to the gynae when the woman is pregnant, when yeah. they go for ultrasounds.
They don't go the rest of the time.
But in actual fact, it's important for you to be there. I mean, I recall when I went in, because I had been experiencing this pain for a good 2 weeks. And I'm talking about the latest episode, which was less than a month ago, which I'm still recovering from. Because Surviving ICU was based on my experience in 2015. It's a memoir in a diary format as well. But for me, The most difficult thing was the fact that the first appointment I went by myself because I didn't think it was such, you know, it was going to be such a big deal.
Yeah.
But I mean, so imagine in a case where a woman has just done blood tests and a pap smear. And imagine you at your gynae by yourself. You think, because you didn't expect the news, right? You go there thinking, no, it's just going to be a normal routine checkup. So you get there, and then the gynae has to break the news that you have cervical cancer. So imagine you're by yourself in the room, right? Mm-hmm. Exactly. So that's why it's important for your man to be there, not just for the pregnancy ultrasound. So now the doctor, imagine if the doctor had said to me, you have cervical cancer. Now I have to drive home by myself. Mm. I mean, I'm a risk on the road, and I'm a danger to society because I've just heard the C word, and then I have to go home and relate it to my husband. Now I'm reliving the whole experience again. So am I not better off having my husband with me when the gynae breaks the news?
So then he gets the information same time
exactly.
you do.
Exactly, and for me it was fibroids, it was cysts. Luckily it wasn't as hectic as endometriosis because that's a different story altogether.
But you were admitted to ICU. I mean, this must have been serious.
No, it was. It was serious. I mean, you get admitted in ICU because there's a 50% chance of survival and there's a 50% chance that you're not going to come out on the other side.
What do you think of, first of all, your kids?
Absolutely, you know, especially because you go through phases. You know, I don't know what they call it. You know, denial, acceptance, and anger, and all of that. You go through all of that. At some point, I actually didn't have the will to live, so I went through those phases. To a point, and then you come out on the other side thinking, hey, you're a mother. Your kids didn't ask to be born.
Yeah, you've got to.
You have a responsibility. You brought them to this world. You wanted to be a mother. So now, if you're not going to fight for your life, if you're giving up on life, or if you're having thoughts that you want it to be over, what's going to happen to this 6-year-old and the 10-year-old at the time? Because that's how old they were. And you realize that you're actually being selfish because you're going to leave these two boys behind. But at the same time, you got to understand that, you know, if you're not strong enough for yourself, how was it going to be in a position to look after my kids or to even think about the fact that I was a mother when I was struggling myself?
Who did you write the book for? Other women who are going through this? For people who are interested in you?
Young girls who have reached puberty because they're going to have to deal with this. Once they start with their menstrual cycle, this topics like fibroids and cysts can't be avoided. And kids are getting younger and younger. Kids who are experiencing fibroids and cysts is getting younger and younger. Any woman, 50% of women of childbearing age will experience fibroids in their lives. So, you know, between you and I, Mabale, we know of somebody that has experienced fibroids.
True.
If we don't know of somebody, chances are it's going to
you
be...
You are that somebody.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But you have a sister, your mum, you have friends. Partners need to read this book so that they know how to give support to their partners.
Mm.
So this is a book, if you're of childbearing age, you need to read it. And even if you're a mother and you're going through menopause, chances are you have a daughter or a granddaughter or a godchild that will experience this in their lifetime. Because the stats are alarming.
Now, you say in the book that the pain was so bad that you actually thought of killing yourself.
Not killing myself.
But you would have preferred death.
By then, this was later on in the year, after surviving ICU, later on in the year, I suffered a pulmonary embolism. And if you remember Vuyombuli,
he
died within 20 minutes. So I had pulmonary embolism. And so here I am. So, like, there's no ways of describing the pain, and I talk about it in the book that if you've ever been in a black taxi, and I know you're a cheese boy, you've never been in a black taxi. you slam the sliding door of a black taxi, that big Quantum. If you've ever, by mistake, tried to slam the door and your fingers were caught in it,
right,
to a point where you swear like a sailor, and the taxi is full of people, but you the pain is so bad that you actually don't even care about the elders in a taxi because it is that painful. Or if you're cooking pap, I'm sure you've cooked pap, Mabale, right? I'm not sure about Gareth. I'm sure he's got a chef at home.
My chef.
So if you've cooked pap and you know as you're mixing.
Yeah.
In the pot and it's boiling and bubbles onto your skin. That's not even close to. I'm trying to get to a point where you
and
understand.
Where in your body is it sore when you have a pulmonary
the
embolism?
Lungs, because pulmonary embolism.
Right.
That's
so it's like you can't breathe.
Like if I breathe in like that's like a dagger.
Oh my god!
A dagger going through your heart. People, they say the closest to it is labor pains. I can't relate because both boys I had by C-section. So, but it's excruciating to a point where I knew that painkillers were not strong enough. Morphine did not work on me, and morphine is strong stuff. The morphine you get given in ICU, right?
Yeah.
Morphine did nothing for me when I experienced pains from PE. So, in the middle of the
night... Did they manage to dissolve it?
It did over 4 days, but I still had to be on warfarin for another 6 months. But the reason why I wished for death is because I knew, seeing that no pain meds were effective, I knew that the pain will only end if I were to die. And I wished for death at that moment. That's how painful it was, and I did not even care about life or my sons or my husband. I didn't think or care about anybody else. I really just wanted for the pain to end.
Oh my god, that's desperation. Now, were you also on antidepressants?
In ICU, I remember a nurse coming up to me, brushing my hand because I was in tears. Because I was overwhelmed. And she rubbed my hand and she said to me, you know, most of the patients who come out of ICU get onto antidepressants. But at that point, I had already started to stop feeling sorry for myself. Because remember, I said to you, I'd gone through phases. So I had an option to take antidepressants. But I was like, you know what? Let me see if I can do it on my own. Let me see how far I can push this thing, whatever it was, because I mean, I was really trying to be strong. I was really trying to come out of that on the other side and be able to say, I did it.
Right.
You know, as crazy as it sounds, I could have had antidepressants at the time. And believe you me, nobody could have judged me for that because it was a dark phase. But at that point in ICU, I opted not to because I wanted to be able to say, I did it.
And it worked.
It worked. It wasn't easy.
But I mean, for some people, you know, it's chemical and they need the antidepressants. But in your case, you thought, screw this, I'm going to get my situation under control myself.
There's been points where I've taken antidepressants before because life happens. Like I said, you go through things in life, you know. So, but in ICU, I refused to take them because remember there was a point where I had actually just given up, so there was no point in me taking antidepressants because when you've reached such a low point, you've given up. You sort of, so even if somebody were to suggest that, you know what, you should take antidepressants, it's like, what's the point? You know, I actually don't care. if I live. So what's the point of me taking antidepressants? But at some point in my life, I did take them because life became overwhelming. And it's okay.
But now you get through ICU and you think, well, all right, hopefully I'm on the mend here. And then life throws more curveballs at you because you went through the same thing 2 years ago. I mean, 2 years after this.
Exactly. A month ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've got 27 stitches from below my breast area way down to my bikini.
You think your ovaries hate you?
you know what? I think I should have been smart back in 2015. Had I known what I know now, I would have opted for a hysterectomy. And I wouldn't have experienced this second time around, honestly. So touch wood, but if should it happen again, I really don't have a choice. I will opt for a hysterectomy.
And that, of course, you don't want any more kids, but is that why you maybe didn't rush to have it done in 2015?
A hysterectomy is not a decision you make.
No.
So easily. You don't wake up in the morning and say, I'm going for that. Because, I mean, that's hectic stuff. You know, that's heavy. Mentally, you have to prepare yourself. So it's not something that you sign easily on, you know, the papers just before admission. No. But now, if I were to make a choice today, I'd sign the papers without hesitation.
That must be the most difficult thing to decide. I mean, there are lots of difficult things, but that's right up there.
Absolutely. It's not something you don't even wish any of that on your worst enemy. I mean, but I'm grateful that I experienced this as much as I hate the fact that it happened to me, because remember at some point I was saying, but why me?
Yeah.
But then you think to yourself, if not you, then why somebody else? What's so special about you?
Why would you wish this on someone else?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, if you don't want to be experiencing this and you're wanting to feel sorry for yourself, then why should Mabale go through this and not you?
Correct.
And but I mean, you know, that's a phase that you go through, and then you realize that, you know what, in my case, I went through it because maybe the universe realized that because I have a public platform, maybe it's the way the universe can get the message to other women, because like I said, women are not having these conversations. We're not having these conversations with our partners. Like I said, it's taboo to even have a conversation about your periods with your mom, which is absurd. Because
why do you think there's so much shame around discussing this stuff? And particularly in traditional households and, you know, among people who they feel it's almost disrespectful to talk about this with your elders. It's unhealthy, though. It's going to it probably kills people. There are probably young girls who die because they're not able to talk about this stuff with anyone. And they're probably going through pain and they're going through difficulty and there's no one they can open up to.
Exactly, which is very, very sad. So I'm hoping this book will get girls talking with their dads, because I mean you do have male run households in this country. So I mean, if it's a young girl who's growing up without a mother, then who is she supposed to talk to if she doesn't have any sisters or aunts or any female figures in a household? I need to be having this conversation with my mother. I mean, I'm a 38-year-old woman, and I still find such conversations difficult with my mother. And I'm a married woman, and you're thinking, I should be able to have this conversation with my mother. So I'm hoping this book will, you know, open up that dialogue, because, you know, like I said, the stats are alarming.
Yeah, but I don't think you're alone.
Like, no, I'm not alone.
The stats prove it, but there's also that thousands and thousands of women in this country who just don't have anyone to talk to about this stuff. And even though there are probably some people who they could talk to about it, they're so nervous and shy and embarrassed to discuss half this stuff that it just goes under the table, right? Under the carpet.
You know, for me, what I'm thinking, I mean, I could be wrong. It's strange. People shy away from having conversations about fibroids and cysts as though it is an STI or an STD. I think that's where the problem is, because otherwise it should be easy for us to talk about those things. I didn't ask for it, and there's no ways of preventing fibroids and cysts. There is no ways of preventing it.
How does it happen?
As healthy as you could be. I mean, I'm a physically active person. I mean, yeah. I try to go to gym 3 times a week. I have a good diet. Well, I try and balance it.
You look fantastic.
Oh, you're too kind. I try to balance it. So there's absolutely nothing you can do about it. Remember, it can also be, what do you call it, hereditary, genetic, whatever you want to call it. So there's no ways of preventing it. If your ovaries decide to heat up, they'll decide to heat up.
Wow.
So, I mean, but the best you can do is to have regular checkups with your gynae. That's the best thing that you can do.
Do you think that there are lots of other women in South Africa who don't even know that they have it until it's almost unbearable and too late?
Absolutely. I have a gynae friend who's actually been a studio on my a guest on my show, who said that many a times a woman can actually go through years and years and years without even knowing that the fibroid is there, because it can sit there without causing pain. And you go years and years without even knowing that it was there. But with a cyst, if it bursts, you will know, because it's like burning liquid in your uterus. And no medication can take away the pain.
I have a very sensitive uterus, so you can imagine.
What do you have?
A sensitive uterus, very sensitive.
Okay, yeah. Gareth is very special, right?
Yeah. Me and Caitlin Jenner, we have very sensitive uterus.
It's hectic. Let's just say that Mother Nature has a sense of humor. I mean, not only when women burdened with, you know, childbirth, which I've never experienced, I don't know what it's like, but I mean, I think women were cursed. Childbirth, natural childbirth is a curse.
Yo, that's a hard
thing. In my mind.
What about the women who say, like, oh, I feel more of a woman, Mother Nature?
I don't know child labor pains, but I don't think so. No, thank you.
Tell the truth.
No, I'll pass. No, let's get real.
18 hours later, they're like, oh, it's so beautiful.
It was the most
somebody said that?
Yeah. Most magical experience of my life.
Are you being for real?
There are women who say it, yeah.
No chance. No. There's just no ways. You know, so I think we were cursed. I'm not sure what we did besides, you know, giving away the apple or whatever it is.
That was it.
I'm not a religious person. I don't know the Bible much, but we must have done something really bad.
I find your honesty refreshing, because I do believe that when, you know, when some women talk about, oh, the beauty of it all, and I'm thinking, yeah, but you're probably just saying that to make yourself feel better.
Exactly.
About how difficult the process actually is.
Validate you.
People need to stop romanticizing these things.
No, there's nothing romantic about natural childbirth. No, come on. Please. Zero chance. Never. No. No ways.
Who are your closest friends? I mean, are these people we would know? Are they not celebrities? Are they not well-known people? Are they just people who've been around you a long time?
I have a very good friend who happens to be a cousin of mine. I mean, we grew up in the same road in Pimville.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, I'm 38. We're the same age. She is real to me. Whether I've been up there as a so-called celebrity or personality, whatever.
Sure.
Dark moments, she's always been there for me. And that's one of the things that I had to really, really scrutinize when I was discharged, because I realized that a lot of people that I thought were close friends turned out not to be close friends. So if I were to pick out one person now, besides the person I've just spoken about now, Sylvia, who's a cousin of mine, Matthew is my soulmate. And Matthew showed me a side that I never knew, not only as my husband, not only as a man, but the fact that he had to step up, not only as a father, but the fact that he had to obviously fill my shoes as well, because not only was I hospitalized for 2 weeks and spent 4 days in ICU, but the recovery period was 6 weeks, which wasn't easy. And he was there for me. He is the only person, and this coming from somebody who would have birthday parties and I would have 120, 140 people at my house when I'm throwing house parties.
Wow.
Exactly. To one or two friends who came to hospital like once in the 2 weeks that I was there. That's what I learned. And what I learned is that times like these you should actually be grateful for, because it helps you to spring clean junk out of your life. I'm going to put it as bluntly as that. I'm grateful for what I went through, because now out of 120 people that would fill up my house and drink French champagne and eat away all the food that we had in the house, now I'm probably left with three people that I consider very, very close friends. And those three people, one of them is Matthew. The other two, I'm not even sure about. The only person I'll mention is Matthew.
But that's incredible that you two found each other. You've managed to not only be, you know, physically into each other, you've got a real emotional connection, but now you're also best friends. And when you say soulmate, I mean, that's like at the top of the pyramid.
You know, the thing is, what we have, that's why I'm always amazed that people, I've got people who comment, wherever there's Matthew, there's Sonia, and the other way around. But the thing is, we enjoy each other's company. We play golf together. We go to the arcade, and as tall as we are, we go to the arcade and we play Pac-Man. And the kids are at home. This is our date night. You know, we would be in our All-Stars and Supegas, and we go to the arcade and we play. So that's what we do. And I mean, we go out and play. When you play golf, you're stuck with somebody for like a good 5 hours, right? Or the whole day, actually. And we enjoy that. We play once a week. So we actually enjoy being in each other's company.
Do you ever get sick of each other?
No. I know a lot of people are not going to be happy to hear that, but no,
That's amazing.
That's
amazing.
We don't need to spend time away from each other, because you must remember Matthew has a wicked sense of humor. So there's never a dull moment. So he keeps me laughing, and I think I've got a good sense of humor, but he's got a wicked sense of humor. And he's a very, very intelligent guy. I'm sure you've been in his company.
Sure, absolutely.
He's very sharp-witted. But so you know, a person like that, you can never get bored.
You know what they say about footballers' wives, right?
Don't go there.
No, really.
Matthew's retired, so I don't qualify to be called a disky diva, whatever they call it, or a wag, or a footballer wag. And you know I've always, I know where you're going with this. You know I've always hated that term. No.
I know.
He's retired now. He's a political science student now, you know. And football analyst, so don't call me a wag. Don't disrespect me like that.
Yes,
no, don't.
Damn right.
He's an author's husband.
Oh,
you know,
that's why I love
that's
you.
That's it. Not the other way around. True. Anybody got time for that?
That's the reason
business
I love
woman's
so
husband.
And he's a cook, by the way. I didn't tell you that I brought you
but you're
salted.
A cook.
No, I'm not a cook. Matthew is a 5-star Michelin star rating. Let me tell you what I've got in this bag, right? I brought you what he made the other day. Salted caramel chocolate brownies.
Stop right now.
Yeah. Ooh. And Don and Salter, please pass around and please taste.
Oh my goodness.
So and he also made an apricot baked cheesecake. He makes Amarula baked cheesecakes.
Okay, this is the moment.
What a talent.
And please be honest, but I mean, I can tell you right now.
You're married to a chef.
Yeah. He is amazing. I love that reaction. Where's your piece?
I'm going to have just now.
Okay, wow. I'm watching it.
There's a caramelly filling. What is that? Oh, this is
so it's salted caramel chocolate.
That's
brownie.
Beautiful.
Just be careful of the you know, the paste.
But this is gonna put like 100 kilograms in all of us.
Yeah, and he makes it using Lindt chocolate. Right?
Oh wow,
the good stuff.
How delicious is that?
Oh, this is dangerous.
Listen, we love having you here at Cliff Central. We love your show.
Thank you.
Opinion Booth with Sonia Booth today at 11 o'clock. There's lots of other good stuff coming up. In fact, Bumi's here for Disrupt, which is the next show, and there's lots of other good stuff coming up through the course of your Tuesday morning. And Sonia, it's a great pleasure to have you as part of our family, and your family as part of our family.
Thank you for welcoming me into this family.
Sure. About time we sat down and talked. Mm. And don't miss that. Opinion Booth, 11 o'clock today.
This is CliffCentral.com.